Chapter 8, The Cosmic Web. In 1933, the Swiss astronomer Fritz Zwicky, that's Z-W-I-C-K-Y, Americans would say Z-W-I-C-K-Y, the true pronunciation being Zwicky because he's a Swiss German, but we will ignore that and we'll call him Zwicky, was observing the Coma Galaxy cluster. Through the large telescope of the Mount Palomar Observatory in California, when he saw an anomaly. He had been making calculations about the galaxy's luminosity, and when he compared his observations with his gravitational calculations, he saw that they showed wide discrepancies. So he concluded that unseen matter must exist there to account for the gravitational forces. He would call this unseen matter dunkle materia, dark matter. Yes, he was the discoverer of dark matter. And as regards dark matter, which would eventually become widely accepted in the scientific community, my position is that one does not need to invent strange new kinds of matter, since it is plasma in different states, gaseous, liquid, solid, etc., that is in the dark mode and hence invisible to us. This fits perfectly with what we know about the universe consisting of 99.9% plasma, bearing in mind, too, how hard it has been to photograph or even find the Kordalevsky clouds and they're on our doorstep. But what is important for this book and this chapter is that Zwicky produced evidence to show that space is not empty. Until then, outer space, in quotes, had been assumed to be totally empty, consisting of a perfect vacuum, with the exception of the solid orbiting bodies such as planets, moons, asteroids, etc., within the solar system and stars outside it. In other words, no medium was recognized. What happened to Zwicky after his discovery is an example of how blind and stubborn ignorance can hold back our understanding. Because of the tactics of ignoring new findings by the self-styled establishment. The expulsion of solar material into supposedly empty space was discovered from observation in 1936, 3 years after Zwicky's discovery, by the French astronomer Lucien-Henri d'Azambuja, while he was using the observatory telescope in Paris to look at the fiery material spewed out by the sun. After D'Azambuja's discovery of the solar wind, astronomers simply ignored it, as they had ignored Zwicky. Many famous astronomers continued to insist in the most vehement fashion that space was empty, and this remained very much the astronomical establishment's position. There is nothing like establishments, of all kinds, to ignore advances in new findings and try to retain the status quo. And we must never forget that there is a status quo of ignorance, which is precious to the mediocre minds incapable of original thought who make up the establishment. During the early 1940s, Zwicky tried to publish further evidence that space is not empty, but publication of his findings was refused by every astronomical and physical journal in the world. The establishment derided and insulted him, and closed ranks to try to prevent his findings from ever being made public. Finally, in 1950, Zwicky was able to get around the boycott of his discoveries only by turning to a biology journal, Experientia, which extraordinarily agreed to publish his astronomical findings so that he could somehow get them into print. It enabled Zwicky's ideas to be circulated at last, even if only in off-prints from a biological journal that no astronomer had ever seen or heard of. It eventually became clear that the censorship of Zwicky's findings had been illegal, especially considering that his own observatory's committee had acted to ban publication of his findings in all American astronomical journals, which they had no legal right to do. This remains one of the great scandals in American science and also of Swiss science. However, the situation has become even worse today, For now, it is not only observatory committees that prevent things from being published, but also the organized and combined forces of military, security, and corporate power. Most scientists working in astrophysics in America today have signed confidentiality agreements with military agencies, and a large proportion of their work is kept secret under various security classifications, many of which are wholly unnecessary. If the scientists try to release their findings, they can go to jail. Even when some such documents are released, so-called, in redacted form under freedom of information laws, the release is often only technical. For instance, one relatively uncontroversial scientific report commissioned by the CIA decades ago that I wished to see, as it had been officially released some years ago, released in quotes, can only be seen if you make an appointment and go in person to the CIA archive in Maryland, where you cannot copy it or take notes. It is remarkable what a short time ago it was that all the world's scientists insisted that outer space was empty. In 1961, the French physicist Alexandre Duvivier published his book La Poussière Cosmique in France, which appeared in English in 1963 as Cosmic Dust. This was certainly one of the first full-length books, and possibly the only one at that date, to devote itself entirely to the subject of cosmic dust throughout outer space. In writing his book, Duvivier, a distinguished physicist who had worked closely with Louis de Broglie, one of my scientific heroes, felt that he needed to keep explaining and almost apologizing for the fact that he was writing a book about something that not long before everyone was convinced did not exist. Here are some of his remarks. Quote, "It was thought until recently that cosmic space was absolutely empty. At the beginning of the century, 1900, it was still believed that interstellar space was completely empty and transparent. 20 years ago, in 1941, the space separating the galaxies was also considered a complete void. 10 years ago, in 1951, intergalactic space was considered absolutely devoid of stellar or dispersed matter. The work of F. Zwicky with the Large Telescope of Mount Palomar showed that intergalactic space is not absolutely empty." Unknown until now, there were two other scientists who clearly realized, even before Fritz Zwicky did, that outer space was not an empty vacuum. This information has come to light very recently from the archives of Sir Fred Hoyle, which have been deposited at St. John's College in Cambridge. Chandra Vikramasinghe, Fred Hoyle's former student and his closest collaborator in his later years, has been going through the unpublished portions of Fred Hoyle's autobiography. I thank Chandra for sharing with me some sections of this material that provide the unique information, and I am grateful to the estate of Fred Hoyle for permitting their use. We learn from these unpublished portions that Fred Hoyle and his friend and scientific colleague, Ray Littleton, had together decided by 1940 that outer space was not an empty vacuum, but was full of gas, by which presumably Fred means ionized gas that we now call plasma. However, they went much further than that. What follows are quotes from papers originally written for a book that would be published in 1994. Quote, "In 1940, Ray Littleton and I suggested that the gas between the stars was likely in places to be clumped into much denser clouds than astronomers were then prepared to admit. We also suggested that the gas in dense clouds would be molecular rather than atomic, with molecular hydrogen the dominant component. These perfectly correct predictions never did us much good, however, because they were thought outlandish in their own time. And 3 decades later, when observation had shown them to be correct, nobody remembered what had been said as long ago as 1940. So it goes, I'm afraid. The thought that molecules, even quite complex molecules, might be present in great quantities within dense clouds of interstellar gas never died away in my mind. although astronomical opinion through the 1950s was so firmly set against the idea that to argue for it in the scientific literature became impossible. Throughout my career, I have argued fiercely against the refereeing system practiced by nearly all the so-called serious journals. My opinions are admittedly colored by an intense dislike of being told by referees what I may publish or not publish. But this is not the whole story. The superficially plausible reasons for maintaining the system are false. The real reason for the existence of the refereeing system is that it provides the majority with a strictly applied censorship over ideas which it does not wish to hear. Because in the 1950s, the seemingly respectable vehicles of publication were closed to the concept of molecules in space, I turned to the disreputable vehicle of science fiction. My novel, The Black Cloud, was written in an irascible mood immediately following an international meeting of astronomers. The novel had the effect in my mind of connecting molecules in space with life. Although by imagining a life form very different from terrestrial forms, I was unfortunately off on the wrong track. End of quote. Fred was not necessarily off track after all, as he realized much later. The sad story of Hoyle and Littleton being unable to publish their views echoes the troubles of Fritz Zwicky in the 1940s. We will return to Fred Hoyle and his contribution to this story in Chapter 11. However, for all the importance of the work of Zwicky, Hoyle, and others, the scientist who probably did the most to throw light on invisible matter in space and to prove that space is not empty was Birkeland's fellow Scandinavian, Hannes Alfven. Now, he was Swedish, and they don't pronounce Alfven, A-L-F-V-E-N, in the way that I just did. The Swedish pronunciation is something that I'm just not going to use, so I will call him, erroneously, Alfven. The Birkeland currents were given this name in 1967 in honor of their discoverer, and called then by that name in Alfven's article on the importance of electric fields in the magnetosphere and interplanetary space, which he published in that year. Alfven's breakthrough was to follow up Birkeland's speculations by identifying plasma as the medium by which electric currents could travel through space. As he extrapolated what he discovered about the currents running between the Sun and the Earth, first to the galaxy and then to the whole of the universe, this breakthrough would lead to both a radical new understanding of the contents of the cosmos, and also by coming to an understanding of the mechanisms by which plasma carried the currents, and in turn the effects of currents of plasma, a greater understanding of plasma and its extraordinary properties. By studying Alfven and his followers and their discoveries, we can begin to see how plasma in general, and the Birkeland currents in particular, are fundamental to the way the universe works. Because Alfven showed that the universe has this vast network of plasma filaments carrying electric currents, he also showed that the universe is full of electromagnetic fields. In fact, Alfven's electric currents in space produce a complex and dynamic interaction of magnetic fields, magnetic currents, and electric fields throughout space. The charging of particles in plasmas and space by electromagnetic fields in turn modifies the electromagnetic fields. Whereas once space was thought of as empty, we now know that at a subatomic and quantum level, space is a jungle of plasma, a highly charged creative ecosystem, with matter in the form of particles being one of the things it creates. Alfven showed that a Birkeland current is a stream of either negatively charged particles, electrons, or positively charged particles, protons and positive ions, that can travel for immense distances through space, many millions of miles, or even billions of miles, at speeds not far below the speed of light, along a twisted rope, using his expression, not made of dense matter at all. The rope is made entirely of the charged particles themselves and the magnetic fields generated by those streams of current. Scientists call these ropes filaments. When there are several of them seen at once, they are referred to as a filamentary structure. Sometimes they consist of substantial bundles of filaments, and sometimes of only two, which are literally a double helix. I should point out that all power transmission lines on Earth are double, either in the form of a two-wire line or a single wire inside a tube, which is known as a coaxial cable. Of course, transmission lines can be multiple, but they must at the very least be double. Superconductivity is an extraordinary phenomenon, first observed in 1911, by which a current can pass through certain materials and experience zero resistance. Classical physics cannot explain how this works, and the quantum mechanical explanation is still not complete. But in 1970, Laszlo Szolimar and Donald Walsh, two particularly brilliant scientists, clarified the nature of superconductivity to a large degree by pointing out that superconductive filamentary currents consist of a central magnetic field surrounded by whirling layers of current vortices. They specifically stated, quote, "Thus, in a simplified manner, we may say that there is a normal region surrounded by a supercurrent vortex. There are lots of layers of such vortices." End of quote. Bicoulon currents are far more efficient at conducting current than any dense matter conductor could ever possibly be, and they have very little current loss, despite the fact that they can extend not only across our solar system, but across our entire galaxy, and even beyond. Indeed, galaxies themselves seem to be linked by Bicoulon currents. There are many photographs of Bicoulon currents in space, and there are many on the internet and in books, to which I shall refer in a moment. The loops that are seen extending upwards and outwards from the sun's surface and from the solar corona, which is far above the surface, are also Bicoulon currents. They are sometimes called magnetic field lines by astrophysicists, which is incorrect. They are actually the glowing traces of the charged currents themselves, and there are many photos of these currents taken from the International Space Station, which show a kind of eerie, glowing green river running along beside the space station and encircling the Earth. The charged particles that reach the Earth from the Sun are mostly positively charged, made of protons and ions emitted by the Sun, and they stream along Bicoulon currents towards the north and south poles of our planet. They are literally space rivers of positive current streaming into our planet and into all other planets in our solar system as well. What this means is that there are threads connecting the Sun with all of the planets, which is thus in continuous direct communication with all the small fry by means of these rivulets. Of course, the rivulets get all twisted up because of the revolutions of the planets, and sometimes the rivulets are shut off, and then new ones start up again. Bicoulon currents beneath the surface of our own Sun are known to be 40,000 miles wide, as mentioned earlier. The ones linking stars are far larger, and ones linking galaxies in filaments to form the cosmic web of the universe are so gigantic that they are much wider than the diameter of any sun or star. Many have been observed and recorded by astronomers, including the Sloan Great Wall, that's its name, a filament that is an amazing 1.37 billion light-years long. That's quite a wall. That beats the one with Mexico. Bicoulon currents can also be microscopic. Our bodies are full of them. It is because of the nature of such infinitesimally small currents that we are alive as we will see in the final chapter. The way in which the robes twist to form Birkeland currents in a double helix shape is really rather astounding. Does this remind you of anything? Yes, there is a distinct similarity between the structure of the DNA molecule and a Birkeland current. Not only is this, in my opinion, no coincidence, but we shall see that since the 1970s, there have been cell biologists insisting that charged currents flow along the DNA molecules inside our bodies and that they are superconducting. Double helixes not only carry currents, they transmit information. All of this is getting us closer and closer to what I believe to be the nature and structure of a plasma body, and to the reasons for believing that intelligence can evolve in plasma. But first, we must return to look in more detail at the way Birkeland currents function in space. We will see the current standard understanding of electricity and magnetism is still insufficiently developed for us to get our heads around it all. As one example of our failure to comprehend the great mysteries that surround us, I come to what we call magnetic lines of force, or magnetic field lines. These are constantly spoken of by scientists around the world, as if they really existed. But they do not exist. Just in case you think I am being fanciful, here's what John P. Colern and Anton Matuszek say in their physics textbook, The Language of Physics, A Foundation for University Study. Quote, field lines are a fictitious pictorial representation of a field. Unquote. Field lines are used in the way that contour lines we draw on maps are used. The real landscape is not covered in contour lines. When we climb a hill, we do not say, oh, I just stepped over a contour line. Similarly, magnetic field lines are merely aids to visualization, and they are not real. So where does this leave us? Didn't I say that Birkeland currents follow magnetic field lines? Well, yes. I was using a figure of speech. Now let us examine a bit more closely how a Birkeland current is formed and how it works. It all starts with a push of currents of electrically charged particles emanating from a source. The push forward of the current is facilitated by what we call an electric field. At this point, I should pause to admit that although scientific talk on these matters is confident and well established by custom, it is often hemmed in by ignorance. For example, we don't really know what fields are, but we talk about them nevertheless until we find some other way of discussing them. I tend to believe that electric fields are spiral waves, so we have charged particles called electrons, assuming it is a negatively charged electric current rather than a positively charged one, consisting of protons and ions, spiraling along, pushed by something we call an electric field, though we don't know what that is or what charge is either. But to return to the question of how a Birkeland current is formed, we do know that electric fields are always perpendicular to magnetic fields. These currents flow as if along magnetic field lines, meaning they follow a direction laid out for them by a large pre-existing magnetic field. As the currents move on their merry way, each creates a private magnetic field, known as an azimuthal field, around itself in a circular fashion, which is thus at right angles to the electric field, but parallel to the larger magnetic field, within which these tinier ones appear. Willard Bennett, in his book Fundamental Principles of Physics, written jointly with his colleague Hermann Heil, showed a section view of a normal copper wire carrying electricity. The picture showed a slice across the wire so that it was coming straight at you out of the page, and it showed its surrounding field. A black dot in the center represented the wire, and all the circles around it were the lines of force, in quotes. And Bennett describes the convention, the usual agreement, as he calls it, whereby, quote, the lines in this figure are drawn nearer each other from positions close to the wire than from positions farther out, which is in accord with the usual agreement to represent field intensity by the number of lines per square centimeter in areas perpendicular to the lines of force. In other words, you squeeze the lines closer together to show a stronger field. And the drawing is, he says, to illustrate the fact that the magnetic lines of force are circular about the axis of the wire. In other words, scientists have agreed a convention whereby the fictitious lines are drawn closer together to represent increased field strength and further apart to represent declining or weaker field strength. There are no real lines, but there is assumed to be a real field, just as on a contour map there are real hills represented, but their contour lines are fictitious indicators of height and may be bunched closer together to indicate a steep incline. With regard to electric currents, the self-generated mini-magnetic field of each current then constricts that current as if it were choking it. The first person to observe that magnetic fields at right angles to electric currents displaced the current and caused it to deviate in its course by a certain angle was Edwin Hall, 1855 to 1938. He made this discovery in 1879, and it is named the Hall effect in his honor. What happens with Birkeland currents surely is a kind of extension of this phenomenon of the Hall effect, causing a slight deflection of angle. But obviously, we need to do a lot more work on this issue, and part of what needs to be done is to understand better the double helix phenomenon of the Birkeland current, as I shall now very briefly explain. The magnetic currents applied at right angles to Birkeland currents have the result that two currents running parallel to each other start wrapping themselves around each other in a kind of perpetual lover's embrace. As we have seen, they twist up into a double helix and flow on like twisted ropes. Their two surrounding magnetic fields join and become stronger as a result. This constricts and compresses the plasma of the double helix further, and at occasional points, nodes, which means special compressed points like knots, nodes are formed by this inward pressure, called Z-pinches, or in America, Z-pinches. In fact, having been discovered and explained in 1933 and published in 1934 by Willard Harrison Bennett, certain types of the plasma pinches, known as Z-pinches or Z-pinches, are now generally called Bennett pinches. Plasmoids, plasma blobs, form at these points and begin to spin, thus attracting surrounding particles and matter in space to themselves and forming clumps. These are essentially energy whirlpools or vortices. The current flowing through the Birkeland currents then continues to supply energy, what is called becoming a maintenance current, supplying energy to the spinning plasmoid, which goes on expanding. It was suggested originally by Alfven that by this means, gigantic Birkeland currents streaming through space form stars, which started out as little plasmoids, spinning, and continue to pump them full of electrons. The pinches can also create atomic matter, X-rays, and vast quantities of neutrons, which are large particles with no charge, called neutrons because they are electrically neutral. In a portion of the pinch known as wait for this, the sausage instability. Don't ever let one of those into your kitchen. At the Z-pinch points, where matter gets sucked towards the streaming currents, a process called Marklund convection takes place. This is named after the Swedish plasma scientist Göran T. Marklund. The matter settles into layers, with the lighter elements wrapped around the inner part of the cylindrical current and heavier elements forming progressive layers outwards. The different elements are thus separated spatially and available for the formation of solid bodies in space in separate bundles, as it were. A theory of, quote, the electric universe, unquote, has grown out of Alfven's work. It states that our sun has electrons streaming into its poles from galactic Birkeland currents, and protons and positive ions then burst out of the sun to form the solar wind. According to this theory, our sun is powered by streams of electric currents from a filamentary web of gigantic current streams linking all the stars in the galaxy. On this view, Birkeland currents supply huge currents of electric power, and they are surging around the universe in filaments. The filaments that fill the visible universe are so obvious when seen through powerful telescopes, they have led to a widespread acceptance among astronomers of the idea that the universe is a cosmic web. The best practical reference source to turn to for a description of Birkeland currents in astrophysics is Antony Perrott's book, Physics of the Plasma Universe, which appeared in a much revised and updated second edition in 2015. Perrott was a pupil of Alfven's, and he is the world's leading proponent of and expert on the electric universe theory. As previously mentioned, he is a very high-profile scientist associated with American government agencies. For several years, he was scientific advisor to the U.S. Department of Energy, and he has been the acting director, National Security Nuclear Nonproliferation Directorate. He has worked at Los Alamos on nuclear tests and is internationally renowned for his plasma research, and Hannes Alfven was his PhD supervisor. Here is what Perrott has to say about the electric power filaments that I have just described. Quote, "The high conductivity of cosmic plasma permits electric currents to flow that constrict the plasma to filaments. These current-carrying filaments form transmission lines, which allow electric energy to be transported over large distances. Transmission lines consist of an assemblage of two or more conducting paths. Transmission lines on Earth, used for communications and the transport of electric energy, employ conductors that are usually arranged parallel to a common axis," in other words, side by side. "This need not be the case in space, and is often not the case in filamentary current conducting plasma in pulsed power generators," unquote. So, it is possible to show, as I have done from time to time, two photos, one on top of the other. One shows the filamentary structure of the universe, and the other shows the neural network of a human brain. I hate to tell you this, folks, but they look just the same. We will see that not only can we be confident that all dusty complex bodies, such as the Kordalevsky clouds, are filled like this with a web of filaments, we can also be confident that our bodies are, too. The filaments meet and connect at intersection points, which scientists call nodes, N-O-D-E-S, nodes. A great word, remember it. Nothing to do with blowing your node. In interstellar space, these are stars. In intergalactic space, they are galaxies. But at whatever scale, the pattern of a filamentary web keeps recurring. Alfven was, of course, the leading disciple of Christian Birkeland. He and Perrott have carried forward Birkeland's ideas about Birkeland currents. If Perrott's book is the ultimate Bible for this subject, Alfven's book, Cosmic Plasma, 1981, is also fundamental. Alfven and Perrott, in turn, have a disciple named Donald Scott, author of the book The Electric Sky. Scott is a retired professor of electrical engineering living in America. My wife Olivia and I have been very pleased to get to know him and his wife Annis, and for me to have the privilege of speaking at the same conference with him on one occasion on the subject of the electric universe. As for Birkeland, he was ridiculed in his lifetime for his theories about the aurora and was only proved correct in the 1960s when satellite data became available to us. Professor Alfven was also ridiculed for supporting the theories of Birkeland, which he did from the 1930s onwards. But he too was finally vindicated and was fortunate enough to live sufficiently long for this to happen in his lifetime. unlike poor Birkelon, who died prematurely. Alphen waves are named after him. And if something is named after you, things are certainly looking up. Time and again in history, science seems only to progress via vicious ridicule, followed by vindication and reluctant hypocritical acceptance by most of the people who have spent years insulting the innovative thinkers. Christian Birkelon and those who have followed in promoting his idea of electric currents streaming through space have defied orthodoxy and ridicule and have put forward a far more convincing explanation of how the universe works. I certainly believe them to be correct. The 99.9% of the universe that is plasma is not sitting there inert. It is fantastically active and dynamic. And we shall see shortly that as plasma beings, we are part of that universal process.